Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington, D.C.
Currently, the president of Zambia is the chairperson of the Organ on Politics, Defense and Security. This role has allowed for His Excellency to be able to play a critical part in bringing stability to the region.
Zambia's President Hakainde Hichilema appoints Mulambo Haembe as the new Minister of Foreign Affairs and International Cooperation.
Well, it may well not last. That's one of the risks we run in this political territory we have moved into. But I don't think the most important question is whether the government lasts or not. It is the extent to which this government is able to advance the agenda that will tackle the biggest problems that we have.
South Africans react to the new government of national unity. We'll have an analysis.
The Convention People's Party was formed by Osagyefo Dr. Kwame Nkrumah when he led the UGC. So yesterday we had to go to his grave, and then we went to all the sawpon and went through the process that he went through and formed the party.
And the Convention People's Party, or the CPP, celebrates its 75th anniversary in Ghana. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Zambia's President Hakainde Hichilema has appointed former Justice Minister Mulambo Haembe as the new Minister of Foreign Affairs and International Cooperation. The announcement follows a mini-cabinet reshuffle which saw a gender activist take up the Justice Minister portfolio while Haembe becomes the country's top diplomat. Haembe, who is a lawyer and a parliamentarian, was a justice minister while also acting as the foreign minister for the last 5 months. Observers say the president appears to have a lot of confidence in Haembe for simultaneously holding two cabinet positions before the president's decision to move him to the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and International Cooperation. I reached Haembe via video link to talk to him about how the administration plans to use diplomacy to ensure regional stability, peace, and security in the Southern African region. Here's part one of the conversation.
The vision really is consistent with that which President Hichilema has made absolutely clear to the whole world from the time that we assumed office. Ours is anchored on two pillars, economic diplomacy with the added twist, shall I say, of looking at development, economic and social development for our people, to bring jobs, to bring the numerous benefits that economic diplomacy, which is properly managed, can bring. And the second pillar will, of course, be looking at our own ethos as a country, as a people. From time immemorial, we've always talked about being peaceful. And we want to be able to take those ethos a little further. And so our diplomacy in the region, on the continent, in the globe, is also anchored on peace, security, and stability. So really, those two combined are aimed at delivering what we can for the people of Zambia and the global citizens to the extent that we can.
With some specificity, talk to me about the steps you plan to take to actualize this vision.
I'll give you a few concrete examples. We have had very close relations with various like-minded nations, many of our neighbors, for example, in the region. Currently, Zambia is the chairperson of the president of Zambia is the chairperson of the Organ on Politics, Defense, and Security. And this role has allowed for His Excellency to be able to play a critical part in bringing stability to the region. We have neighbors such as the Democratic Republic of Congo, Mozambique, where there's been some dispute. My role as Minister of Foreign Affairs and International Cooperation is to anchor the efforts of the Southern the SADC region in trying to bring those hostilities to a close. Naturally, That is a long process, but the efforts have to be made from both a diplomatic perspective and in terms of the force that has been deployed in the Democratic Republic of Congo, for example, to assist in bringing a little bit of stability to that region. What are the knock-on effects of that? Naturally, the knock-on effects would be where we have a stable environment, it fosters trade, it fosters development, it fosters a region which is stable and which is an attraction to the rest of the world in terms of investment. So that would be one of my practical steps, and I'd have to ensure that on a daily basis, I am engaged with my counterparts and with other key stakeholders in the region to bring this particular ideal to actuality. I can give a few more examples. We have had interaction with the United States of America, for example, and our neighbors, Congo, in relation to the critical minerals and electric vehicle value chain. And of course, the role of the Minister of Foreign Affairs at this point, the groundwork having been laid, would be to ensure that we have an effective implementation model to bring again this partnership that has been put in place into a reality by ensuring that we provide oversight, by ensuring that we bring the parties together in terms of the sector ministries involved and the private sector as well to bring this particular areas of cooperation to fruition. Also, we have the Lobito Corridor, which again, we are partnering with the US and the private sector in the US. That is a corridor for trade, joining Angola, Zambia, and the DRC. Again, the idea is to bring trade and investment to the highest possible level using this particular corridor so that goods, services, and people from the US who want to partner and work with us here have a clear pathway by which to do so. And these agreements, the frameworks, the legal documentation have been put in place. Now what needs to be done is for us to see actual results of this particular initiatives that have been already worked on. And that will be my role now as a more or less an implementer.
Malambu Haimbe is the Zambia Minister of Foreign Affairs and International Cooperation. He spoke with me from the Zambian capital, Lusaka. Join us on Sunday for the conclusion of the conversation. Still in Zambia, an independent parliamentarian has sharply denied involvement in hate speech. Munir Zulu is one of the five people recently arrested on espionage charges. This following their earlier allegations via social media that the government was involved in the recent abduction of independent lawmaker J.J. Banda. They were subsequently charged with hate speech and sedition. It also comes after President Hakainde Hichilema warned at a press conference that those who engage in hate speech will face the full force of the law. But parliamentarian Munir Zulu tells me that the charges he faces are politically motivated to silence him.
First of all, I don't practice hate speech, Peter. Hate speech is only in a certain group of people. And then I was not in court for hate speech, but for seditious practices. Granted bail, there's no hate speech. Because the state delayed to give me a charge as they were trying to fish around the law as to what charge was to be given to myself.
Some people are suggesting that your recent comment following the abduction of a colleague member of parliament was bordering on hate speech and sedition, and that what you are doing is to create hatred towards some tribes or ethnic groups in Zambia, which they argue is dangerous to the country's unity.
I agree, but at no point did I mention of a single tribe. So how does the issue of tribe come in? I never called for cessation. I only demanded that let the honorable member for Petaoke Central be found. Why is it that the police don't want to go for the named abductors, but they want to have him detained for funny cases like aggravated robbery and attempted murder when the country wants to know what happened to a member of parliament They don't want to allow him to give his side of the story. He tells you that there's something fishy.
But the police are investigating the circumstances that led to his abduction, and they are also investigating the allegations of those who are supposedly behind it.
No, the police are investigating what they want to believe is self-abduction. JJ is alive and is able to remember his abductors. He mentioned their names. Why has the police not summoned those named from State House?
But they are still investigating. Why don't you allow the police to complete their investigation?
Fine. If they're investigating it, why are they willing to continue keeping him in detention so that he does not tell his side of the story? That's a question. You can't tell me he was abducted 2 weeks ago and the police are saying we're investigating him for a matter that happened 8 years ago. Does that make sense?
But the fact that he has allegedly committed a crime over 8 years ago does not preclude the police from charging him with the crime that he allegedly committed 8 years ago.
Peter, I agree. What would be happening is tomorrow a member of parliament is abducted. The next it will be members of the diplomatic corps that are going to be abducted. No one is safe. No one is safe. It's not a matter that we should handle lightly. Members of parliament have been abducted before. So why do you want us to continue where someone was even tortured after the abduction?
Critics of the opposition have said that Honorable Banda could have created a publicity stunt like that just to demonize the administration. So they also called for the police to complete their investigation to find out who allegedly abducted him, tortured him, and to bring them to book.
Look, JJ Banda's vehicle has a tracker on it. All the movements are known how he moved. So they're not talking to the tracking system on that vehicle. Why? It has a tracking system. Secondly, if indeed he abducted himself, why don't they allow him to give his side of the story? Is it because he mentioned State House staff?
Some of your critics are saying you are in the habit of always speaking loudly, bordering on hate speech. And that is why some of your critics are saying that you are a danger to not only the Zambian parliament, but to the Zambian society as a whole.
Peter, before 2021, I never heard of an offense called hate speech. I condemn tribalism, number one, Peter. This you should know. I'm not a tribalist. I'm not a racist. But I condemn those that practice it. Now, those that practice it are running propaganda to say, I'm a tribalist. They don't want anyone condemning the practices. When you condemn it, they label you to be practicing hate speech. It's unreasonable. So now, Peter,
yes.
I want you to get some very clear from me in summary. Between an oppressor and the oppressed, I side with the oppressed.
Munir Zulu is an independent Zambian parliamentarian. He spoke with me from the capital, Lusaka. A leading political analyst says South Africans demand improved living conditions and challenges they face resolved quickly, irrespective of who is in government. Professor Tinyiko Maluleka also says reactions have been mixed following the announcement of a coalition government due to the outcome of the May 29 national elections. This as the African National Congress, or ANC, agreed to form a government of national unity with the main opposition Democratic Alliance, or DA, the Inkatha Freedom Party, and the Patriotic Alliance. Some South Africans say the ANC sold out to the pro-business Democratic Alliance, while others say the newly formed government of national unity is the best to solve the challenges facing the country. For analysis, I read Professor Tinyiko Maluleka.
There are two extremes. The coalition is seen as a complete right-wing coalition. that is not going to take care of the poor, especially because of the link with the DA. That's the one extreme. The other extreme is, of course, to see this as a savior government, a messiah government that will solve all the problems of the country, because for the first time you will have the left and the right collaborating, the black and the white collaborating, and therefore everything is going to be hunky-dory. I think that both extremes are extremely wrong. South Africa has now moved into uncharted territory. There are no certainties anymore. Anyone who thinks any certainty will come out of this, either a certainty to the right or a certainty to the middle, is making a mistake. We can't, we have no guarantees.
You talked about certainty and uncertainty. Some are worried that this might not even last because it appears to be a marriage of convenience, they argue. What are your thoughts?
Well, it may well not last. Of course, that's one of the risks we run in this territory, in this political territory we have moved into. It may not last. It's possible, but I don't think the question, the most important question, is whether the government lasts or not. It is the extent to which this government is able to advance the agenda that will tackle the biggest problems that we have.
But do you see this coalition solving the big problems? High unemployment rate, the living standards of South Africans, the lack of energy or electricity that most South Africans complain about, especially Eskom's inability to manage the power situation. Do you see this coalition government solving this? Because they all complained about it.
Yeah, you know, this coalition government is arguably, if you just look at numbers alone, it is arguably the best possible arrangement, except that the truth is that if you looked only at numbers, the three ANC pieces could easily form a government. But I think that that government has less chance to survive than the one we have now. So, yes, if they can use their numbers to charter a way forward that tackles those problems of the country, yes, they are likely to last. Because if they don't tackle those problems, people are going to say, what's the difference of having a government of national unity and having the kind of government we had before? Because both of them are failing.
President Ramaphosa has called for unity in the country and the need to solve problems. And what do you think are the expectations of South Africans following the formation of this coalition government?
I don't think any South African is under any illusion that things are going to get easier or that this new government is going to wave a magic wand and suddenly things will be easy. I think we expect turbulent times ahead. We expect trouble ahead, instability and even backbiting inside and within government. But above all, we demand, I think that's what many South Africans will say, we demand that the problems of the country be addressed and be addressed urgently. We are running into problems when it comes to energy, when it comes to water, when it comes to the sustainable development goals as a country, and everyone, I mean, South Africans doesn't really care what you call this government. And to some extent, they don't really care who's in it, as long as they attend to the problems of the country.
Professor Tinyiko Maluleka is a political analyst. He spoke with me from South Africa's capital, Pretoria. In Malawi, the spokesperson for the United Transformation Movement, or UTM, is calling for calm as members of the party speculate about the circumstances surrounding the death of Vice President Saulos Chilima. Until his demise, Chilima was the leader of the UTM, which formed a coalition with the Malawi Congress Party that led to the Tonse Alliance, which won the last presidential election. UTM spokesperson Felix Njawala also says several opposition leaders have expressed their support and condolences to the family and the UTM following the death of Chilima, who died in a plane crash. The president has since declared a 21-day national mourning period. Chilima's state burial is on Monday, according to the government. For more about what the public should know about the deceased vice president and the party's next steps forward, I reached UTM spokesperson Felix Njawala.
Well, it's a shock. It's a shock to all of us. We never expected such a thing to happen. And these 2 days has been very depressing for us. Hence the confusion within the Ford. But we have managed to look at this situation as something that as leaders we must sit and see how we can forge ahead. But really, it has been a shock to all of us.
I am aware that President Chakwera has declared a period of national mourning. How has the government, the opposition, the rest of the country united in this mourning period?
Well, there is some kind of good atmosphere within different political parties. In as far as unity is concerned, we have received conference messages from most of the political parties that we have. They have been coming to visit us. So yes, the atmosphere is good because almost all the political parties are concerned with what has happened. Yesterday, we had a leader from UDF. We had a leader from Ford, you know, coming to condole the party leadership. Yeah, so far, that's what I can say.
What has been the reaction of supporters of the party?
We have mixed reaction from the party membership. There are so many theories that are going around, and they have all, chosen their perspective to use. So we, as a party, we have tried our best because the tension is there. But as leaders, we are doing our best to make sure that there is calm.
What is the message of the UTM party to the people of Malawi in this period?
Our message is very clear. We want our members to maintain calm and order, besides whatever theories are there, because we don't want anything to work against the dignity that the legacy that he has left. He always taught us to be orderly and peaceful. So we want that to maintain and continue, because that's what he taught us. And it is our responsibility as leaders to ensure that is maintained and kept.
What does the world and Malawians need to know about the man, Salos Chilima, who was the leader of your party?
It's very difficult to express exactly who he was, because he was everything. He was a man who changed the dynamics of politics in Malawi. He inspired young people to get involved in politics. He brought in a new dimension of how politics must be done. He was a transformative leader. He was a family man. He was a good person. He made friends with even enemies. Even those who betrayed him were his friends. So he had that character that all of us don't understand. It would be very difficult for me to express or explain it, exactly who Dr. Chilima was.
Felix Njawala is the spokesperson for the United Transformation Movement, or UTM. He spoke with me from the Malawian capital, Lilongwe. In Namibia, a lecturer at the Department of Political and Administrative Studies at the University of Namibia says the coming general election will be the most competitive in the country's history. Professor Rui Tiatende says the Independent Patriots for Change, IPC, a breakaway party from the governing SWAPO, could dislodge the Popular Democratic Movement as the second largest party. His remarks come after McHenry Venani of the main opposition party accused the Namibia Central Intelligence Service of destabilizing opposition parties. This, he says, is aimed at boosting the electoral prospects of the ruling party, SWAPO, in the coming November 27 polls. The government has since rejected the accusation. Presidential Press Secretary Alfredo Hengari says the allegation is an attempt to generate sympathy votes for Venani. For the latest political development, I read Professor Rui Tiatende.
We are in a election year, so we should expect all sorts of politicking to occur. The remarks that were made by Venani comes at a time where SWAPO is also facing serious challenges from the opposition parties. They lost for the first time since independence their two-third majority in parliament, even though it was by a small margin. In 2019, their presidential candidate was severely wounded, having only obtained 36% of the vote compared to 87% in 2014. So from that perspective, SWAPO is worried. However, the allegation being made by Venani, it has not been proven. It's maybe electioneering also on his part, but intelligence organizations, especially within the African context, are known to serve at the pleasure of the government of the day.
Presidential Press Secretary Alfredo Hengari dismissed the allegation, saying that it appears Venani wants to garner sympathy vote with this allegation. Your thoughts about his rebuttal?
Of course, one would expect Alfredo Hengari to say that the press secretary of the head of state. Secondly, is also that it could be that Venani is aware that his party is also facing a serious challenge from a party that was recently also established in the name of the Independent Patriots for Change, the IPC. Forecasting that I have done indicates that the Venani's party will not be the official opposition come 27th November because of internal dynamics. Most importantly is the issue of ethnicity, because Namibians to a large extent they vote on the basis of ethnicity. Secondly is the issue of IPC having emerged from the ranks of the ruling party. So again, the remarks by Alfredo is understood in the context, he's just doing his job, but even if it were true that the intelligence service is interfering in the internal politics of the country in terms of trying to destabilize opposition parties.
Some people are suggesting that if Venani has empirical proof, he could present it in parliament at the Foreign Affairs Committee that also handles the intelligence agency to address his concern rather than come out publicly to make such an allegation. What do you make of this?
To a certain extent, I do agree. Because if you have evidence that the Central Intelligence Service is there funding other political parties, because he made the claim that the intelligence organization is funding a newly formed party by the name of Action Democratic Movement to create some sort of confusion amongst CDM's constituents that Popular Democratic Movement and Action for Democratic Movement could be a political party. So in that instance, if Venani does have proof that the intelligence service through whatever means was funding this political party, they were actively involved in the registration of this party, the state apparatus, whether it's State House or the intelligence or any other members of the public were in touch with the Namibia Central Intelligence Service, then this should be brought to the Parliamentary Standing Committee to investigate further. Because this is a very serious allegation, and one cannot just wake up, make those allegations, especially of an intelligence organization that is supposed to be impartial. These guys operate in secret. That's the very nature of their work. So even if they were, even if there was evidence that they are doing it, my hunch is that they will deny it to the court.
Do you expect this coming election to be very competitive?
Absolutely. It will be the most competitive election ever since the dawn of democracy. Namibians are grappling with unremitting levels of unemployment, the second most unequal society on planet. Youth unemployment is high at 36%. Food insecurity is affecting everyone. Now we are even in the worst drought that we've ever experienced since independence. So there's deep discontent that is permeating throughout society.
Professor Rui Tetende is a lecturer at the Department of Political and Administrative Studies at the University of Namibia. He spoke with me from the Namibian capital, Windhoek. And you are listening to Nightline Africa on the English to Africa service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, in Ghana, the Convention People's Party, or the CPP, led by founding president Dr. Kwame Nkrumah to attain independence, is celebrating its 75th anniversary. Nana Frimpomaa, the chairperson of the opposition CPP, expresses confidence about the party's continued relevance. She says that the CPP will pose a significant threat to the electoral prospects of both the governing New Patriotic Party, the NPP, and the main opposition National Democratic Congress, or NDC, in the coming general election in December. Critics, however, say the CPP has lost its relevance and has failed to attract support from the country's youth. They predict the party will perform poorly in the December polls, but Nana Frimpomaa disagrees. She tells me that the Ghanaians are gravitating towards the CPP after the two leading parties disappointed voters by failing to improve their living conditions.
The Convention People's Party was formed by Osagyefoto Kwame Nkrumah when he led the UGCC. So yesterday, we had to go to his grave, and then we went to all the sawpon and went through the process that he went through and formed the party. We went by the tree that he planted on that day, 75-year-old palm tree. And what he said was that as he planted the tree, Ghana would grow as a tree keeps growing. Now, the relevance of the Convention People's Party, me mentioning the tree, is the fact that the purpose for which he led UGCC, the reason for which he formed the Convention People's Party, the song that he sang, which is Lead Kindly Light, One Step at a Time, and where he stood to weep, were there yesterday.
Is the party relevant today?
We are doing our best. And let me give a little history to that. When the party had power, it is the party that did the most accelerated growth in terms of economic empowerment. The party having at its center the welfare of the people and the development of the people as it saw as its main focus, made sure that everything, self-reliance was the number one word. And so, most products that were consumed in Ghana were now started being produced in Ghana. CPP is more relevant today than before because the two major parties, the MPP and the NDC, the youth of the country are exhausted. They've tried their policies. All the neoliberal policies have shown clearly that it can't take Ghana anywhere.
Some of your critics are saying there are strong divisions within the party. The intra-party conflict has made the party unattractive to the youth. That is why they question the attractiveness of the party to win power in the next few years. How do you respond to that?
I will, to some extent, agree with them, especially now that political party here in Ghana and other parts of Africa has become so monetized to the point where you need so much money to do something. But the only good news that I still maintain and we have is the fact that the Ghanaian youth is tired and exhausted. Now, talking about the infighting. The infighting has always been in every grouping and in every political party. The disadvantage of where we stand as CPP is because of the vision that CPP is and the focus. All the ideology, our policies, when they are implemented, will definitely let Ghana work again. So all these two parties and every other person out there try all the time to make sure that they fool out the little inter-confusion that is everywhere. We've seen them in MPP, we've seen them in NDC when they were doing their elections, but they still are able to get themselves together. So yes, CPP, we've had our issues, but we are still working towards it because more people are coming to join the party.
Yes. What do you think the electoral prospects of the CPP are in the coming elections in December?
Now, there are two major issues fighting CPP currently. The group, which is myself, who are focused on doing the grassroots election. I believe that we'll be able to pass through that. If we're able to do that as we are doing now, because we've done everything that the grassroots is now mobilizing. Every constituency in Ghana has a polling station-specific booklet with 20 applications done for 47 locations. All the booklets, every polling station is like a roadmap. Now, they have started really enrolling themselves. If we are able to finish that one up by the July 25th, as we intend to do the election for the flag bearer, I strongly believe that CPP will give the two parties a big run for their money because of the new policy, the new economic policy that we are coming up with called the New African Order.
Nana Frimpomaa is the chairperson of the Ghanaian Opposition Convention People's Party, or CPP. She spoke with me from the Ghanaian capital, Accra. In Uganda, the executive director of the Anti-Corruption Coalition is welcoming the arrest of three members of parliament over allegations of corruption. Marlon Agaba, however, says the government must demonstrate its commitment in the fight against corruption. Previous prosecutors of top public officials, he adds, have failed to lead to jail terms, which Agaba says thwarts the war against financial malfeasance and wrongdoing. His remarks come after three lawmakers were recently arrested for soliciting money from the Uganda Human Rights Commission in order to increase its budget. For more on the fight against graft and malfeasance, I reach Marlon Agaba, the executive director of the Anti-Corruption Coalition in Uganda.
One, of course, we welcome the arrest of the members of parliament, and the arrests come at the back here of the address by the president, being the State of the Nation address, that he had the information about a racket of corrupt officials at parliament and in the Ministry of Finance. So the developments are welcome, but what we should remember is that, one, we have had so many scandals that start quite well, with arrests, with investigations, but often they end in incomplete, not in any conviction and not in any recoveries, they end in total disappointment. And this has happened before. But also, we should know that the racket is much bigger. The officials in the Ministry of Finance, the officials at Parliament, who have had allegations of involvement in terms of the other technical staff at Parliament, we have had allegations against the Speaker of Parliament and members of the Commission, but we're only seeing a few individuals being arrested and taken to court actually today.
Well, some supporters of the NRM are saying that the President appears to be serious about his renewed call for war on corruption.
Of course, we do welcome the developments and his commitment, beginning with the members of parliament. But what I'm saying is that from precedents, from history, it has shown that in most corruption cases, we usually have a few sacrificial lambs that they will be arrested and taken to court to bring to the public that the president is serious about corruption. Yet the other high-ranking officials don't come out. Parliament is headed by the speaker, and there have been allegations against the speaker, have the deputy speaker, we have the parliament commission, have the budget committee, but we also have Minister of Finance involved in this, and the permanent secretary, we have the ministers, and have other high-ranking officials. So the question is, why only three members of parliament? who don't seem to be senior, even in parliament. So I think it goes back to the whole question of selective prostitution of individuals, and often the high-ranking officials going unpunished. So we have seen this before, and most likely it is playing out again. So much as we welcome the reformment, but we are also a little bit pessimistic in terms of the caliber of the officials that have been arrested and tried in court.
So for anti-corruption activists, what specifically do you want to see that you will appreciate the renewed commitment of the president or his administration in the fight against corruption?
There are several high-ranking officials that have been mentioned in these rockets at the Minister of Finance and at Parliament, including the Speaker of Parliament and the Parliament members of the Parliamentary Commission. They have been mentioned in several corruption scandals. We want to see them also being investigated and brought to book, because the challenge here has been selective prostitution. We want to see fairness in all of this. We want all the officials, including high-ranking officials who are involved in corruption, who have been allegedly involved in corruption, we want to see all of them investigated and prosecuted in court so far.
What are your expectations of how things will pan out, if you may?
I think, this is not a new script. The same script has been used before. That they will, of course, be arrested, likely arrested. Today, they are being charged in court. And, of course, after some time, either today or another day, they will be granted bail, and they will be out on bail, and they will retain their offices. They are going to remain as members of parliament. And then, of course, the case will go on. You know, hard cases are going on for 2 to 3 years, sometimes 4 or 5 years, and they can also appeal in case they are not satisfied with the decision. So that will take you like another 5 years. So probably the case could take 5 to 10 years before being determined. And like in most cases, like for the politicians, most of them have been acquitted in the long run. They have been acquitted and they haven't really served in time in jail. So there is nothing much really to be optimistic about right now, because it is the same script that they taken to court and charged. They're given bail, and then the case is dragged on forever and ever. And in the end, they're acquitted.
Marlon Agaba is the executive director of the Anti-Corruption Coalition in Uganda. He spoke with me from the Ugandan capital, Kampala. Africa's longest river flows through 11 countries, helping to sustain more than 200 million people directly or indirectly. However, the very lifeblood of these nations is under threat from increasing human activity upstream that poses a significant risk to the river's Nile's fragile ecosystem. For VOA, Sheila Pony reports from Bo in Jonglei State, South Sudan.
The Nile River is the second largest river in the world. It provides crucial resources to 11 countries, including South Sudan, the world's youngest nation. Luis Ring, Luis, executive director at Community Action Against Plastic Waste in South Sudan, says, as dawn breaks each day over this ancient river, its waters carry a silent plea at the center of a 21st century environmental challenge.
The river cries out, choked by the bare hands it feeds. We stand here today to silence that cry, to transform habits, and to introduce sustainable solutions for our people.
Community Action Against Plastic Waste is a youth-driven NGO. Luis, the organization's founder, says this once majestic, ancient lifeline for civilization is now facing a severe environmental threat.
The Nile is bleeding red, not with blood, but with plastic and waste that suffocated waters. Our town, river, and future are all interconnected. The situation here in Bor is dire, and it is our duty to act.
Environmental experts predict that more frequent and intense heat waves could cut the Nile's flow by a surprising 75% and spark conflicts over water resources and food insecurity, and heighten health risks related to inadequate water supply and sanitation. Joseph Africano Batal is South Sudan's Undersecretary of the Ministry of Environment and Forestry Management. He explained the importance that water quality has for all those who live and work near the banks of the Nile.
people drink water directly from the Nile or from the streams, resulting into cholera, diarrhea, and other waterborne diseases. So the only solution to improve the quality of water in South Sudan is to establish liquid, solid, and medicinal waste management.
Les believes a good beginning would be for the government to facilitate workshops to teach effective waste management, implement policies that discourage single-use plastic consumption, and provide trucks to regularly collect waste from people who live along the riverbank, like this teenage boy.
So, the reason why we are here, we are cleaning the riverside. It is our lifeline. So, it is to protect us from the other diseases.
In the longer term, community action against plastic waste invasions, regular waste collections, plastic levies, and fines for littering to enforce environmental awareness. But for now, those challenges aren't on the government's immediate horizon.
So now, as a country, we have joined with the UN, United Nations Environment Programme, through the Intergovernment Negotiating Committee. We are coming up with a treaty that will ban plastic pollution globally.
Lewis says the story of Bor and the Nile is at a crossroads, and the path they chose today will determine if the river continues to sustain life or becomes a relic of the past. Sheila Oponi, VOA News, Bor, South Sudan.
And right now it's time for music from African Collection.
Mwenye wivu wa jinyonge, mwenye wivu wa jinyonge, mwenye wivu wa
That was music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed it.
Papa m'a payé les études, j'ai eu mes diplômes, j'ai même fait des formations, mais je n'ai pas du boulot. Ah papa, je suis toujours au chômage. Président Bamba, papa m'a payé les études, j'ai eu mes diplômes, j'ai même fait des formations, mais je n'ai pas du boulot. Ah mama, je suis toujours au chômage.
Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English to Africa service of The Voice of America, and from the rest of the Nightline team, including producer Douglas Impuga and engineer Anna Kudian. We say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, if a tree does not know how to dance, the wind will teach it. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Aujourd'hui j'ai eu tous mes diplômes, y'a toujours pas du boulot. C'est encore papa qui me donne l'argent du loyer, et c'est toujours maman qui me dépense l'argent de poche.